Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Tariq Ali's new book, The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power, demonstrates Pakistan's unique influence on the emergence of a secure world or global conflagration. The West's good war in Afghanistan has turned bad. A local solution, rather than a neocolonial one, is needed. Spreading the war to Pakistan was a disaster for all sides. One way out of the impasse would require a withdrawal of U.S. NATO forces, either preceded or followed by a regional pact to guarantee Afghan stability. Tariq Ali spoke recently in Manhasset, New York, at an event sponsored by United for Peace and Justice. And now, Tariq Ali.
The most depressing feature of the present administration's foreign policy is that they appear to be continuing the previous administration's policies in relation to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in fact, if one examines them closely, going even beyond the previous administration. Why is the United States in Afghanistan? The war in Afghanistan was a direct result of 9/11. And so people accepted it. It was a crude war of revenge. Its aims were very limited. And the president himself declared, when asked, "What are your aims in Afghanistan?" said, "To capture Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, and to destroy Al-Qaeda." Well, Osama bin Laden has not been captured, dead or alive. Al-Qaeda's influence, power, and influence has waned, but that's about it. From that point of view, it's not been an incredibly positive move. On the other hand, what has happened is almost 8 years of occupying Afghanistan has created havoc in that country, led to the loss of numerous civilian Afghan lives. Thousands of Afghan civilians, innocents, have been killed. A few NATO soldiers and American soldiers have also died. And the country is in a complete mess. The bulk of Afghanistan, the majority of the population, 60% lives in the south. These are Pashtun people belonging to different tribes. And they have cousins and brothers and kinship networks with people on the other side of the border with Pakistan. This is a border that extends for thousands and thousands of miles over mountainous territory. It is a border that it is impossible for anyone to police. So obviously, when the Pashtuns in Afghanistan are under attack, Pashtun tribes on the other side of the border get agitated. Many of them on the immediate borderlands have a sense of solidarity with their people who are suffering on the other side and try and help them. This is not such a big surprise. If you say, what has been the effect of the United States' presence in Afghanistan for the last 8 years, I will tell you that the effects have largely, overwhelmingly been negative. The government which the United States placed, put in power in Kabul, is a corrupt government. Hamid Karzai, the president, his brother, is a well-known smuggler, deals in the heroin trade, in the arms trade. There's no trade he doesn't deal with, and he is now a billionaire. This tiny group of people have stolen prime land in the heart of Kabul and are constructing expensive villas where they live or they rent to foreigners. All this under the protection of NATO troops. So you can imagine the impact that has on a majority of the population, which is amongst the poorest in the world. Billions have been sent into that country. How many dwellings have been built for the poor citizens of Afghanistan? A few hundred at most. So where the hell is all this money going? And which group of people are lining their pockets? You know, to pose the question is almost to answer it, the people in power. That is what they're doing. Then you have a whole army of foreigners imposed on this largely tribal country with ancient, very conservative traditions, regardless of whether they are Sunnis or Shia or anyone else. They are essentially tribespeople who come from very old traditions. This may not be a good thing, but that's just a fact of life in that part of the world. And foreigners come and occupy that country with their traditions. Some of these traditions include servicing the needs of the army in terms of massive transportation of food so that the soldiers can be fed, in terms of the mushrooming of brothels in Kabul and Kandahar to serve the needs of the soldiers who are there. And it creates a total shock in that culture. So more and more people from within the Pashtun sections of the population have been joining what is called the Taliban, or what British intelligence now calls the Neo-Taliban, because its character has changed considerably, and are resisting the foreign presence. It has been a disaster. And even Hamid Karzai, this puppet president, now publicly says that the West is killing too many Afghan civilians. And if he says it, it's because it's hurting him. People see him as an agent of the occupation, and so hold him responsible. So even he is now saying, please don't kill too many civilians. But the style of the war in Afghanistan is such that they can't do anything else. Because if you bomb from the air, if you send in drones, if you target villages with missiles because you've had intelligence, usually faulty, that in this particular house in a village or in these two houses there's a nest of terrorists and you knock them out and it later emerges that these are all innocent people. In a part of the world where the culture of revenge is very strong, what these people then do, the families of those who've been killed, is go and join those who are fighting. Or even if they don't join those who are fighting, they make sure that they help those who are fighting. Now, if this is the condition in Afghanistan, then what sense does it make going in for an occupation for another 5 or 6 years, spending billions more, trying to create an Afghan army and police force and train them? What is the point of that when the majority of them will defect at the first possible opportunity to their relations, to their cousins, to their kinship networks who are fighting the United States? Just look at what has happened to this country. The Russians came in 1979 to help pro-Soviet government that was then in place in Kabul. The United States backed religious groups, jihadi groups, the Pakistani military dictatorship, created a very strong network in Pakistan to drive the Russians out, and they succeeded. Having succeeded in driving the Russians out, the United States then forgot about the region where they had once created these groups, hired people, trained people, told the Pakistani military intelligence, given it unlimited sums of money to train people to send them to fight in Afghanistan, including Osama bin Laden and his followers. But then they lost interest. And there was a civil war after the Russians had left, and this civil war destroyed large chunks of the country, and it became ungovernable. From the road from the Pakistani border to Kabul, you could be stopped 5 times or 10 times by 10 different groups of armed militias, each of them asking you for money as a toll. Trade became impossible. At this point, the Pakistani government dispatched the Taliban, mainly kids of Afghan refugees in Pakistan, backed by the Pakistani military logistically, and they took Kabul. Gradually, they imposed their hold on the whole country. They were extremely conservative religious people, and they imposed a very strict regime on the Saudi model. The model they chose to impose on Afghanistan with its different traditions was a Saudi model. And the United States should have been quite at home with that. After all, they've been loyal allies of the Saudi Arabian regime since the Second World War. So what was the problem? The problem was that Afghanistan didn't offer anything. There was no oil, there was no wealth, there were no riches. So they weren't interested, though Unoco, the oil giant, was interested and was negotiating openly with the Taliban. And then 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened because Osama bin Laden and his group, using the fact that they had helped these Afghans to come to power together with the United States, demanded refuge and were granted refuge. And from there they planned their attacks on a U.S. destroyer in the Yemen, on U.S. embassies in Africa, the Kenyan embassy in particular, and one of their people, Ramzi Youssef, tried to bomb Twin Towers, I think, in 96. Subsequently, when he was captured after 9/11 through ordinary police work, they were flying him from JFK to Langley, Virginia in a helicopter, and as they passed the Twin Towers then intact, he informed the CIA people with him in the helicopter. He said, that's what we were really after, you know. We wanted to knock down the Twin Towers just to create a massive impact. So it wasn't even a big secret of what these guys were attempting to do. Doing something that was so sensational that the whole world would sit up and take notice. Well, in that they certainly succeeded. And the United States then discussed cold-bloodedly at the National Security Council. A discussion took place, okay, let's use this now to attack Iraq. But some people said, well, you know, no one will believe Iraq was responsible for this. We haven't got the time to convince them, so we've got to do something. Let's attack Afghanistan. And that's when they attacked Afghanistan, but with dire results. And some of us warned at the time that, look, what Al-Qaeda has done is the act of a small terrorist organization. Its membership is no larger than 2,000 or 3,000 people. Yeah, they've committed a crime. They're criminals. Capture them through ordinary police work. Try them in an open court and deal with it like that, like you would with anyone else, with the Unabomber, with the guy who carried out the bombings in Oklahoma. They didn't do it. They went to war. That has now become a running sore in the region. It spilled over into Pakistan, as was predictable, and now the United States is on the verge of doing something which is destabilizing Pakistan in a very major way. And you have to ask why. To sustain an occupation of a country with 30 million people, you are now preparing to destabilize a country with 170 million or 175 million people. Just doesn't make sense. You encourage a degree of Islamophobia amongst your own population and elsewhere in the world, which is becoming the equivalent of what anti-Semitism was in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And this constantly amazes me, that there is so much talk now over the last 20 years of the Holocaust. Correctly so, it should be discussed. It was a crime against the Jewish people in Europe. But it wasn't a crime committed by Muslims or the Palestinians. It was a crime committed by people who regarded themselves as the sort of defenders of European Christian civilization and wiped out 6 million Jews. It was a terrible crime. But the language they used to use about the Jews, these people, is virtually the same as the language being used against Muslims in Europe and in the United States. They're not like us. They're different. They wear different clothes. They have a different religion. They have a funny language. They wear funny hats. They have strange beards. They wear kaftans. They have strange diets. They don't eat pork. All this stuff used to go on. They're strangers in the house. And it built up till you had demagogic politicians who said they're like cockroaches, destroy them, as they launched a war. It's not reached those proportions. But one has to be careful. And despite all the talk and all the education about what it was that led to the Judeo side of the Second World War, it's astonishing to me that people don't make the link that these were a tiny minority in Europe in virtually every country. And this is how we behave towards them. And similar things are repeated. And the big tragedy is that the Israeli government is also on this same line. They use similar arguments, ignoring the use they've been making of the Judeocide till now, blackmailing the Europeans. So one has to be careful. And you know, the notion that Islam is the enemy is a joke. Even if you look at U.S. policies in that region, of which I'm very critical, but look at it. The U.S. has the largest security presence in the Middle East of any other country. It controls Saudi Arabia and Egypt. It has a big presence in the Gulf states, military presence. The largest U.S. base in the region is Al-Adid base in Qatar. What is the threat to Israel? Who can threaten it? This is a country with the sixth largest army and nuclear weapons. But the way it's all presented, it's as suddenly the Israelis are under threat and the U.S. are defending them. It's total nonsense, really. How can Islam be an enemy? This is a religion of, you know, over a billion people. The world's largest Muslim country is not anywhere in the Arab world, it's Indonesia, which has its own long-established cultural traditions, very different from the Arab world. Many, many millions of Muslims live in Africa. So it's a very wide religion, like Christianity is. So this building Islam as a big bogey frightens me, because it tries to point the finger at a whole culture. There must be something wrong within Islam. No one said when terrorists of Christian origins carried out bombing attacks, there must be something wrong within Christianity. People said they're nutty extremists. Quite right, too. The war in Afghanistan, if it's extended, is going to create havoc in the region. It's not going to work. The Secretary General of NATO said something at a talk he gave at the Brookings Institution last year, which when I read the transcript, I was surprised. I said, either this guy is very foolish or he's naive. But what he said, when he was asked by a member of the audience at the Brookings Institution, why are we in Afghanistan? Is it to reconstruct, rebuild, help the people? He said, well, yeah, that too, but that's not the important thing. The reason we're in Afghanistan, we want to have permanent military bases because, he said, we are basically in Afghanistan because, as you know, the center of the world is moving east. China and the Far Eastern bloc is becoming very important. And how could we turn down the idea of having permanent military bases on the border with China? This is either fantasy or it's real. And if it's real, it's foolish. Because you say these things in public and you imagine that the Chinese leaders are dumb or deaf or blind or don't want to hear you. They're not. They take everything very seriously. And they have made it very clear to Pakistan's military, with whom they have good relations, that we are not prepared to tolerate permanent U.S. bases on our border. And the Pakistani military takes what the Chinese say quite seriously. We don't want this to happen. It is going to bring instability to the region. So they will resist if this is what is planned. But we don't know what is planned. I cannot believe that the Obama administration is settling down for 5 or 6 years. Be more death, more destruction. And if Pakistan is destabilized, Admiral Mullen was saying that, yeah, we are firing drones inside Pakistan, and the Pakistani military and Pakistan's leaders understand this, he said to Charlie Rose. Well, they may understand it, but there are people who live in that country. And the New America Foundation carried out an opinion poll survey in Pakistan last year, which showed that 70% of the people do not like the U.S. presence in the region, leave alone firing drones at Pakistani villages in Pakistan from bases inside Pakistan. Obviously, they don't like it. So it's all very well for the military leaders and President Zardari. He's one of the few presidents we have in Pakistan who comes close to being described as a U.S. drone himself. That these guys give you the green light and you go and bomb? Crazy. It's going to create mayhem in the country if this goes on. And the most dangerous thing, of which some of their advisors certainly are aware, that if you do this and create more instability, there is a serious danger that you could divide the Pakistani army, which is a strong institution in the country, 500,000 strong. That's not small. If you divide this army by compelling the Pakistani military leaders to do your bidding, these guys won't be able to control their own armed forces, and then all bets are off. Anything could happen. The big nightmare scenario presented by some American commentators, not just Fox television, but general commentators in sort of more serious media channels, the picture presented of Pakistan is this. There are jihadis on the loose, wild, bearded guys who throw bombs, and which is true, by the way, there are some of them, a tiny, tiny minority, and they are on the verge of capturing the Pakistan nuclear facility. That's just nonsense. It's like saying these born-again groups here are on the verge of capturing the American nuclear facility. It's a joke. And it's similarly a joke to say that the Pakistani jihadis are on the verge of capturing the Pakistani nuclear facility. What might make it a real possibility, not this group capturing it, but some group from within the army, is if you divide the Pakistani military. And that is my big fear of what the Obama plan for Afghanistan is going to do. And that is why it is extremely important for citizens of the United States, whoever and wherever they may be, to try and stop this, to protest, to go to their congressmen, their senators, and say, why are you doing it? To do this, it means U.S. citizens have to educate themselves, because the media certainly isn't doing it. There's very little serious reporting coming out from Afghanistan. The Taliban are painted or demonized totally. They're not people I agree with, but they're not what they're presented to be. But if they were so bad, then why has the U.S. and Britain been negotiating with them over the last year? Pleading with them to join the government in Kabul, to which the Taliban or the neo-Taliban have replied, we're not going to do that unless and until there are no foreign troops in our country, then we're prepared to work with whoever, but now we won't. The Obama plan says that we will pour a lot of money and buy over 60% of the Taliban and bring them on our side. With money? They really have no understanding. This must be advice given to them by the British. Because that's what the British used to do during the days of the British Empire. But they had a big base which was called India. And they did buy over tribes and, you know, hired them as sort of mercenaries. Or as we would say in today's lingo, contractors. It's not going to work in Afghanistan. People might take the money and still fight against you. Which is quite likely to happen. And the money will be used to buy weaponry, to fight against you. So why go through with this at all? What we need from the administration is a rapid exit strategy from Afghanistan and not getting bogged down in that region. And what this exit strategy requires is a serious deal with all the regional powers. That means Pakistan, India, China, Iran, and Russia. And say to them, we're prepared to get out of here provided you lot can work together, create an Afghan national coalition government. It shouldn't be the property of one faction. A national coalition government in Afghanistan. Impose on it your will and say, no violence, no faction fighting, no more war, and for the next 10 years we're going to build the country, create a social infrastructure, which the Chinese have the money to do. I think that probably will be acceptable to most of the Afghan factions. The Pakistani military may or may not like it, but given that they do what the US wants anyway, I think they will probably have to fall into line. And I think that is the only serious solution, a regional solution. I think that would be reassuring, and it would actually restore a lot of stability to the region. Thank you.
And our thanks to WBAI's Fred Nguyen for recording Tarika Lee.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.